Well, if this was an ordinary year, and that's almost silly to say about 2020, we'd be expecting the Olympics to come in about 6 weeks, and I am a fan of the Olympics. Now, I don't know about you, but I really resonated with something that I read in one newspaper account, and they were talking about this year, and one person said in exasperation, "I'm so done with 2020. Let's just start and call it 2021 and begin all over again." And I feel that way about so many things. This has been a very difficult year, and even in this last week, more difficulties were heaped on top, as if we didn't know court decisions that really are going to have a huge impact on the Christian community. But here's where we are. But anyway, back to the Olympics. I always love watching the Olympics, these athletes that prime themselves and get them ready. And one of the premier events of every Olympic is the 100-meter dash. And go through the heats, and finally you get to the final. And this is the moment that's going to decide the fastest man on earth. And there's something about that moment as they get in the blocks, and then they get in position, and the starting gun is about ready to be sounded, and then they shoot the gun, and they're off. And then, bang, almost immediately there's a repeat of the gun. It means somebody has false started. Somebody who's trained for years, somebody who has worked the hardest for that golden moment, and anxious to get out because you know that this race is going to be decided by tenths of seconds, if even that. And they start just a millisecond early, and it's over for them. It used to be at least they got another chance, but in 2010, the rule was changed so that one disqualification and you're out. It's been called the cruelest rule in sports. One false start in a sprinting event, and you're finished. And you see that person walking away with not even the chance to finish what they'd completed. And sometimes it's the fastest man in the world. Usain Bolt, the year after that was brought in, false started in a world championship and lost the chance to have his title. One of the truths of the gospel that is most special is that we are not defined by our failures. That God doesn't disqualify us on the case of a false start, of one failure. That failure can be real, but because of the work of Christ on the cross, it isn't final. We live in a cancel culture. That's the word for somebody who's done something wrong and all of a sudden everything else in their life, because they've been caught out for this and you see it in operation. It is cruel and it is brutal that someone says something that they deeply mean and believe, and because it doesn't fit with the tone of where the culture wants to go, and all of a sudden the howling mobs on social media are all over them and they want to be canceled. Now, we see it in other ways in our culture. People defined by the worst things about them. Now, I want to say that some of the statues that are being pulled down ought never to have been put up. But there are others who are people who've been good and significant, and yet because there is this fault which millions in their time shared, all of a sudden they're to be discouraged. The trouble is, when you live like that, then you're going to receive like that. And you're going to be canceled one day by somebody because of the attitude you've got. But one of the truths of the gospel is that God works with us in our failures, and he not only doesn't cancel us, sometimes what look like failures, false starts, turn out to be the very things that God is going to use to make us into the kind of people that he wants us to become. And that's very true in the life of Moses. Although it took a long time for it to become evident that he was not disqualified because of the way he began. So turn with me to the second chapter of Exodus as we are beginning to walk into the life of Moses and to think of him. And last week, as we began chapter 2 in the first 10 verses, we have the story of the birth of Moses. And then in verse 11, we begin a second stage of that story. One day, when Moses had grown up, he went out to see his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together, and he said to the man in the wrong, "Why do you strike your companion?" He answered, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. I will read on, but let's just stop there. I was reflecting last week on the first verse or the second verse of the chapter when it says, "The woman, Jochebed, conceived and bore a son, and when he saw that he was a fine child, a good child, she hid him 3 months." We talked a little bit about that last week, but it struck me even as I drove home last week that maybe there's something else going on here. Because you remember Pharaoh was saying that the boys, the Hebrew boys, had to be thrown into the Nile. They were to be murdered by throwing them into the Nile as garbage, as waste. But as Jochebed holds that little boy in her hand, she sees that he is good. Now, part of it means he was obviously attractive. Every parent knows what that is. But the word good is the great word that resonates in Hebrews, in Genesis chapter 1 in the Hebrew text to describe God made it and it was very good. And it occurred to me, at least in part, that what Jochebed thought as she held that little baby is, no, this is good. This is what God has made good, this little boy. He can't be treated like rubbish, like garbage, and thrown into the river. And it was because she saw the image of God in that child that this was God's good thing, that he refused to treat it like garbage. Now, I make that point because as we think about what goes on in our culture, in the abortion culture, the very issue is that is not said to be good. Everything is described around it to say it is an intrusion in the life of a woman if she doesn't want it. But God calls us to see good what he has called as good. Well, the first 10 verses track this amazing adoption that takes place when Moses becomes a member of the royal family. And then we come to verse 11. One day, when he was grown, he went out. Now, we don't know it from this particular place. We couldn't tell. But Acts chapter 7, verse 23 says that at the time he went out, Moses was 40 years of age. So between verse 10, being brought up in the house of Pharaoh, and now in this passage, 40 years have gone by. And there's so much we don't know about those 40 years. Think of what had happened in that period of time. It's almost like the Lord Jesus, where we have his birth and then something happens at 12 and then 30, and we have all these questions about what happened in between. Now, there's some things we do know. We know that he was treated as a member of the royal family. He was the son of a Hebrew, an Egyptian princess. We have no idea of what kind of princess, a minor royal, a major royal, but he was royalty within that land. He'd had the finest of Egyptian training. In Egypt, the most powerful country of its day, the most advanced culture of its day, people still wonder, how did they build the pyramids? How did they have all of that knowledge that's involved in engineering and architecture and mathematics and all of those other areas? And he was trained in the wisdom and skills that belong to the Egyptian culture. And he was thoroughly Egyptianized. He spoke the Egyptian language. He held Egyptian values. He'd been trained in that. He knew all of those kinds of things. When we get to verse 19 in the chapter, when he is way out in the desert and he encounters some shepherd girls, they go home and tell their father, an Egyptian helped us. So to see anything about Egypt was to see an Egyptian, pure and simple. 40 is a long way into a life. We don't know. We don't know whether he was a family man. Had he married? What was his family situation? What job, what role? The rabbis make all kinds of stories related to this, that he was a general that led troops. But that's all imagining. We don't know those things about him. What was his relationship with his family? After Jochebed had to hand him over to the Egyptian princess, did they have further connections? Did he know Miriam and Aaron, his sister and brother? What were those kind of contacts there? How did he wake his way through? We don't know any of those things. But I want you to notice carefully verse 11. And the first phrase in that verse is enormously significant. We'd love to know underneath that and come to it. But did you notice? Simply says, one day when Moses had grown, he went out to his people, meaning the Hebrews, meaning the Israelites. Underneath that simple statement is a defining moment. They were his people. And you notice that phrase is repeated again in the text. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. I'm an Israelite, he was saying. I am not an Egyptian. And behind that is a defining moment in his life when deep down he turned his back on everything he'd been trained and everything he'd known, because he identified himself with what his birth position was and what he'd been brought up with. That's not automatic. I mean, all kinds of people come, and for example, I've known lots who, when they come to this country, they don't. My mother came over from England as about a 5 or 6 year old girl, and she was speaking with an English accent when she went to school, and she hated it when people called her English. She wanted to be Canadian, and she fought against any definition. Not much different probably than Moses was in terms of when he grew up, in terms of her age, but she wanted to fit in. And Moses is making a defining choice in his life. Now, the interesting thing is, that's passed over lightly. But when we come to the New Testament, it ponders this moment in his life. So you can turn with me if you want, or just listen as I read the New Testament description of this single moment. By faith, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 24. Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to identify, than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. That says some amazing things. First of all, he was choosing his people. He was making that statement as he walked out on that particular occasion, that I am a Hebrew in a country where the Hebrews were enslaved, when they were rejected, when they were despised, when the first Pharaoh, this Pharaoh wants to eradicate them in whatever means can be done to get them through and finished as a people. But behind that is something else. It wasn't simply that he was choosing his people. He knew his God. Because the interesting thing is, and this is unclear, it was by faith that he did this. And he identified with not just the people of Israel, but with the people of God. And at the end of verse 24, which I didn't read, verse 27, which I didn't read, by faith he left Egypt, not being afraid of the anger of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. Now that says that Moses knew something of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, as we're going to see as we move through Exodus, the Israelites were semi-pagan at this time. Matter of fact, Joshua will look back and say, you worship the gods of Egypt. But somehow, Moses, under the barrage of the indoctrination of the Egyptians, knew that he wasn't one of them. And he knew that their gods were not his God. And probably he needs to come to know more fully that their God is the only true God. And the only way I can explain that is the godly influence of a mother. We're not told much of that. It's hard to imagine that in 3 or 4 years then she was in the process of weaning him very slowly, so before giving her over. She sang songs about God. She told stories about that. She reminded him. And I don't know what kind of effect it had in the larger culture in terms of people recognizing him and thinking of him, but he looked Egyptian in every way, but at his core, he had chosen his identity. He knew who he was, and he knew something about his God, and he knew the implications. Did you hear that in those verses in Hebrews? He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to be mistreated with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered the reproach of Christ greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking for a reward. On one side, pleasures and treasures. The pleasures of sin and the treasures of Egypt. All of those things. Lifestyle of the rich and famous, as the old program goes. Those were all his. He could have had all of those things. Treasures and pleasures. Instead, he chooses reproach and danger and ostracism. I don't know all that he understood. It talks about he chose the reproach of the Christ. But there wasn't that much known biblically about the Messiah at this particular time. And maybe the writer of Hebrews is saying it's related to the people of God and what God's promise was to Abraham and what God was going to do through him. But regardless of that, he was choosing the side that was ultimately Messiah and Christ. I belabor this because in every one of our lives, there is a time in which we make choices. One of the men who had an influence in the movement that I was brought up in, and which I'm thankful to God for, it wasn't perfect, but it was very much a blessing to me, was a man named William Kelly. William Kelly lived in the 19th century. He was Irish. He was a brilliant scholar. He went to Trinity College in Dublin, received high honors in the Greek language, and then he went on to do all kinds of scholarly things, but he was a preacher, that was his, and a Bible teacher. And he prepared one of his nephews for entering Trinity Dublin, which was one of the elite schools in the Great Britain at that particular time. And his nephew came in so incredibly well prepared that the professors brought him into a meeting and said, "Where did you learn this? Who taught you these things about the Greek, classical Greek, all of these kind of things?" And he said, "It was my uncle." They said, "We need to have him come in." They brought him in and they said, "Your language skills and abilities and the way you've trained him, we need you on faculty here. As a matter of fact, we will give you one of the highest chairs in the school and pay everything." And William Kelly looked at him and said, "I'm not interested." And they looked back at him and said, Don't you want to get ahead in this world?" And Kelly looked back at them and said, Which world, brothers? Kelly was saying, I'm living for a different world. I'm living, and that was the choice that Moses made. I know in my own life, there was a point as a high school student when there was all these things going on and I was involved in sports and all of these other kinds of things and the social issues and student politics and all of that. And in my heart, I knew I had to make a choice. And by God's grace, because of the influence of my parents, I knew who my people were. They were nice people. I'm not pointing to this side because of your character, just has to be one or the other. That they were nice people, but they weren't my people, because my people were God's people. And that simple choice as a high school student changed the whole direction of my life. But it's not just one we make then. We make it over and over. So that innocuous little statement, one day he went out to visit his people. Behind that, there's a huge amount of significance. He was a man determined to be among the Israelites and to be numbered at whatever cost. But that good choice wasn't enough. So, the verse goes on to talk about what happened when he went out on that particular occasion. One day when he'd grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. It seems that he wanted to really see what was going on. And as he encountered this and he saw an Egyptian slave master beating down one of his people, the reality of oppression, the reality of what his regime, that his royal side represented, and what that meant for an oppressed people. This was a George Floyd moment, as he recognized his people couldn't breathe. His people had someone's knee on their neck, in this case, a whip in their hand. And all of a sudden, everything looked different. All of a sudden, he began to recognize the systemic evil that was part of what he was part of. And he wasn't wrong in any of that recognition. He saw the evil, and he acts on the basis of that, and he looks both ways to make sure nobody is looking, and as far as he can, that's not the case, and he goes and he kills the man, delivers his fellow Israelite, buries the body in the sand, which wasn't difficult to do, and makes his way on. His anger was understandable. But as James tells us, the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Righteous anger doesn't validate sinful actions. We're seeing that drama played out in our world today. Legitimate protest doesn't validate evil responses. Now, there's more going on. Because at this point in his life, Moses had come to a conviction. He was an Israelite, and they needed him. Acts, Stephen puts it like this. When he was 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brothers, the children of Israel, and seeing one of them being wronged, he defended the oppressed man and avenged him by striking down the Egyptians. He supposed that his brothers would understand that God was giving them salvation by his hand. But they didn't understand him. When Moses did that, it wasn't just an act of evil. He was convinced he was the deliverer, that he was in this position because God had put him there and he was to act on that basis. Now, the ironic thing is that he was both wrong and right. God hadn't called him to be the deliverer. That was his idea. He was self-confident and self-assured that I'm the guy who's going to deliver my people. You are lucky to have me. Now, in point of fact, he was the one God who was going to use to deliver his people. But it wasn't the wrong time. And he's acting on his own, for his own basis. And it was foolish. Killing one Egyptian slave master was only going to make the life of the rest of the slaves, because you know how what that happens. We saw it in the American South, into the slavery system there, that if one slave gets out of line and acts against his master, all kinds of people are going to suffer for it. Violence begets violence. This was not the way to free his people. Only God could work through it, but Moses is acting on his own basis. So the next day he goes out and he's appalled to see a bully beating up a weaker Hebrew. And he steps in and says, "Why are you doing that? He's a fellow Israelite." And the truth is, depravity is mixed into all contexts. All of the depravity wasn't on the side of the Egyptians. There was a lot on the part of the Hebrews. And when he breaks into that story, "Who made you a king and a ruler over us? Who do you think you are?" Well, he thought he was the deliverer. But all of a sudden, there is a crushing realization. They don't want me. They're not looking for me. At least that loudmouth wasn't. And all of a sudden, he's a man on the run. Hadn't prepared for it, hadn't thought about it, but if the killing of an Egyptian was known, then he was a marked man. Especially, he was brought up in the royal family, and if anyone was going to be taught a lesson, it was going to be Moses. He was going to die a slow, painful, agonizing death at the hand of Pharaoh and his people. So we read it very simply in verse 15. When Moses was afraid, he ended verse 14 and thought, "Things known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Pharaoh's going to get me. My people don't want me. There's no place I can shelter in Goshen, which was the area where they were. I am done for. And he flees to Midian. Now, because we don't know the geography, we don't understand what that is, but Midian is about 250 miles to the east in the most desolate kind of country that you can imagine. Desert all the way, broken, miserable desert country, all the way into Saudi Arabia. Oh, every now and then there'd be an oasis and all of these kind of things, but he doesn't stop running for 250 miles to get out of the territory where Pharaoh had any power. That was a semi-nomadic area. The Midianites were semi-nomadic people who moved around the area, who had a relatively well-developed culture, but it was a long way from Egypt, and he was now out there on the margins of life in an area of total obscurity where everything he'd hoped for, everything he'd hoped for, everything he knew was virtually irrelevant. A few years ago, Elizabeth and I had the privilege of going to Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, and Elizabeth was doing some ministry. I was involved in doing some Bible teaching, and one day we went down to the hospital called El Ain, I think was the name of it, and she had something to do, so my friend who was working in the country took me across into Oman. So we crossed the border into the country of Oman, and the more we got in and the more I looked around and I thought, this is where the children of Israel lived. Not literally, this is the kind of, it was the most desolate, barren kind of place imaginable. He's left the glories and splendors of Egypt, and he's out here and he's sitting by a well. Now, a well was critical in that country. Wells were at the crossroads, wells where civilization could come because you need water to live. And so he comes there to the well, and it's a stopping point. It's a rest stop along the way where He didn't know where he was going. He didn't know where he was headed. He had no future. He had no expectations. He's sitting by the well. And then God's providential plan steps in. So you'll notice it in verse 16. Now the priest of Midian. Now the priest of Midian has two names we'll meet in the Bible. Sometimes he's called by his clan name, Reuel, R-E-U-E-L. And other times he's called by his personal name, Jethro. So even though there's two names, it's the same person. In this context, he's Reuel. Chapter 18, he'll be Jethro. The priest of Midian had seven daughters. And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. Now just pause there. He's sitting by the well. I don't know what he was doing, whether he was thinking, what is my next move? Where am I going to go? I wonder who I might meet and figure out what's going. I need news from this area. Whatever he was doing by the well, it was the picture of a lost man in a lost place, not sure of what was going on. And Reuel's daughters come up, and they're in the process of shepherding their sheep. Seven girls doing what usually young boys and men did. And they came and they got to the well and they began to do what shepherds do, draw out water, fill pots, and then fill the troughs with water. So the sheep can drink at this particular place. It's a life-saving issue. And there's another group of shepherds that comes up behind, group of men. And they let the women do all the work, getting the troughs full, ready for the sheep to bring their sheep in. And then they come in and they push their way past. Misogyny goes way back in human history. And they are going to push the women away because they're obviously weaker and take advantage of their work. And at that point, Moses, who's been sitting there watching all of this, gets up and he moves against these men with some kind of physical anger and fury and drives them away. And then the women come and Moses fills the trough again, or whatever, and draws water and gives it to the women. Now, it's an interesting portrait. He's a man who's in despair, and yet when he sees as an injustice, he will respond to that injustice. The same inclination that was there when an Egyptian was beating an Israelite, the same inclination that was there when a Hebrew was beating another Hebrew, a weaker one, when the bully was carrying his task. And now there's women who are being oppressed, and there's something in Moses, instinctively, that makes him take the side of the oppressed and the weaker. It also tells me, he's a significant physical specimen. I mean, to take on these shepherds that were there, and by himself, drive them away with some force, with only seven women who were on his side, says there was something imposing about him. But the most interesting thing to me about this picture is not only those things, but it's the little note that ends the verse. It says, it saved him, and he watered their flock. Moses had spent all his life in a royal palace being served. I'm sure he'd never watered a flock in his life. There were people who did that for pharaohs. But he's serving. The same instinct that got him in trouble is now using providentially to get him into the next place where God wants him to be. And he's beginning to learn to serve. It's interesting that when Jesus said, "What is the mark of greatness?" He doesn't look at a royal prince. He says, the greatest among you is the one who serves. And serving women, culturally, excuse me, women, was not what men did to be men. Men had women serve them. Well, that was a simple act. There was no follow-through on it. He didn't ask for a reward. He didn't ask for anything. He didn't ask for favors or direction or money. He just apparently stayed at the well, and the women went away. And we read in the next verse, "And when they came home to their father Reuel, he said, 'How's it you come home so early today?' They said, 'An Egyptian delivered us out of the hands of the shepherds, and even drew water for us, and watered to the flock.' He said to his daughters, 'Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread.'" In other words, not giving him hospitality from what he'd done was a tremendous offense against Bedouin culture, against Arab culture today. They are far more hospitable and open than our traditions are. And we've been in Israel several times and been in an Arab part, and they want us to come in and they want us to spend time, and we've had some delightful, unexpected occasions sitting around, I think once in the Old City, of one occasion where I learned a whole lot about Jordanian culture just because of the hospitality was there. You violated culture, go and get him. And then in God's providence, we read, "And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah." Somebody I was reading said obviously he had spent some time in Texas, because Zipporah means ladybird. And for those of you who aren't old enough to remember, Lyndon Johnson's wife was named Ladybird. So anyway, it's a bad joke historically, but there it is. "And she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, 'I've been a stranger in a foreign land.'" Gershom just simply means that, a sojourner there. No fixed residence, no home. No home as an Israelite, no home as an Egyptian, just among a vagrant people with no place of my own. And the amazing thing is that he will spend 40 years there in the desert chasing sheep. His life is over. He's in the penalty box. He made a decisive choice, but he failed. So it seems. So what do we make of this? Well, let me just quickly note a few things. First of all, Moses' story, beginning where we begin, tells us we need to know who we are. Are we God's people? Or are we, forgive me, just Canadians, just Americans? Nothing wrong with being a Canadian or American, but if you're a Christ follower, you become called to something much higher than that. What's my defining identity? I am a member of the people of God. By God's grace, by God's sheer choice, he's made me part of his family. They are my people. Their future's my future. Their Savior's my Savior. Their home is my home. And all of us are called to make that defining choice, to know who our God is and who our people are. Secondly, it's a story that reminds me that good motives don't justify bad actions. It was wrong that Egyptian was oppressing that Israelite. It was right that he be stopped. It was wrong that he was killed. Moses knew that he was doing wrong because he looked this way and that before he did what he did. And we need to be reminded that we can't fight God's battles with the world's methods. And that's a huge reminder for us, in the kind of time in which we live, while there's name callings on this side and that side and all of those ways, somehow God's people have to act differently and show the values of the gospel in the way they behave. Third thing this story tells me, and it's not evident here, but it's true, that waiting time in God's hand is not wasted time. Moses doesn't know it, but God is making an investment in his life that was every bit as important as what he had learned in the palace of Egypt. D.L. Moody was famous saying, for Moses' life, I want to keep calling him Abraham, Moses' life was divided up into three sections. First 40 years, he became something in Egypt. The next 40 years, he became nothing in Midian. And all of those came together that in the last 40 years, he did something significant for God. But what he was learning in the desert was going to be the key to what God did through him, both in Egypt and later in the desert. And the last thing is that we need to trust God, even in the darkest times. When Moses fled from the Pharaoh, it's interesting, Hebrews says, not because he was afraid of Pharaoh. I mean, he clearly was. It said the same thing with Jochebed and Amram. They didn't fear Pharaoh. Well, they were afraid. But what the point is that although they feared Pharaoh, they feared God more and acted on the basis of their fear of God, not the fear of that. And Moses is not primarily afraid of Pharaoh. He's afraid of offending his God. And God will use that at a later time. And so we need to recognize that we need to fear the right thing. Fear dishonoring God more than to fear being dishonored. Well, that's the middle of the story. And next week we get to the turning point where things begin to move in a very different direction. But one of the things that is true, that our life will come with trials and our life will come with uncertainties. And yet it's there we learn the truth of who God is.